Welcome to Pause to Go, the podcast that's all about making the most of life's transitions from middle school through menopause. I'm your host, Bree Luck, joining you as we embark on a journey of self-discovery and questionable decisions. Get ready for heartfelt conversations, expert insights, and personal stories that'll have you laughing, crying, and saying, "Thank goodness I'm not alone." If you've lost your midlife crisis survival kit, we've got you covered. So join me, won't you? And together, we can pause to go. Today, we are incredibly lucky to have author Anne Douglas with us. For those of you who may not know, Anne is something of a Canadian legend when it comes to writing about family, parenting, and now the richly textured landscape of midlife. She is the author of 25 nonfiction books, including the groundbreaking Navigating the Messy Middle, a fiercely honest and wildly encouraging guide for midlife women. Anne's work has not only set the stage for honest conversations about parenting across North America, but is now really leading a new dialogue around midlife. And you know I love that. But before we dive into this enriching conversation with Anne, I have something special to share with all of you. You know I love doing giveaways of books, and today, thanks to Anne's generosity, we are doing a giveaway of Anne's book, Navigating the Messy Middle. And here's how you can make this book yours. Simply take a screenshot of yourself listening to this episode, share it in your Instagram story, and tag Awkward Sage Media and Anne M. Douglas. Y'all can look in the show notes for the tags too. I'll put them there. Show us where you're tuning in from, and let's celebrate the fact that making the most of midlife happens in the everyday moments, not just the monumental ones. We will select one winner from all of the posts on March 19th, which is my mother's birthday, so it feels like it's a fitting day to do that. So make sure to mark your calendars, and, you know, my mother's birthday may result in a birthday present for you. All right, let's get to it. I'd love to start with the question that I ask pretty much everybody who comes on the podcast. It's a tried and true question. And that is, how old are you and where are you in your menopausal or midlife journey?
I am 59. I'm actually going to be celebrating a big milestone 60th birthday in about 2 months. So that's exciting. And in terms of where I am in sort of like the menopausal midlife journey, I'm 5 years into menopause. I was 54 when I had my last period. And in terms of sort of like the broader experience of midlife, I feel like I'm stepping over a threshold that like I felt like a midlife person for the last little while. And now I feel like I'm joyfully entering older woman territory. And it's funny because after internalizing so many of those youth culture messages over my entire life, right? Now I'm starting to feel like actually, I am really okay with heading into this, you know, this final stretch of my life. I'm hoping it will be a very long stretch, but sort of being an older adult as opposed to even a midlife adult. And I didn't feel that till quite recently.
Huh, interesting. How do you feel about the word crone?
I have mixed feelings about it. It feels a bit witchy to me. So I'd rather just, you know, think about it as sort of like generational legacy and generativity and sort of like those kind of concepts, learning, growing, sharing, you know, learning from younger generations, passing on wisdom to younger generations. Like I love all that sort of relational language more than the crone thing. Like I don't think I'm going to stand out in the woods and do any kind of strange rituals with other people.
Well, and I think that you hit the nail on the head for me, actually, with I have a strong resistance to the word crone. And sometimes I have to check myself and say, why do you have this strong resistance? How much of this is just your own social sort of indoctrination and fear of being like the threatening older woman, right? That's what it kind of sounds like, that witchy kind of connotation. But I think what you just said in terms of that you like more relational terms really gets there. The word crone is by its nature sort of a definitive term. It's a descriptive term about like a role, right? A role or a type of person that you are. Whereas what you're talking about, relational terms, are more about process. They're more about what action can we take in a phase of life. So thank you for pointing that out, because it just helped me to feel less like my socialization is causing an ab reaction to the term, and instead is making me think, no, maybe it's really more about relationships than a definition. So you're about to turn 60. Do you have big plans for your 60th birthday?
Probably not, because I'm really, really conscious of the fact that, you know, we have not exited the pandemic yet, right? Like, there's so much language about, you know, just go on and do all the things and everything. But I just feel like I have a really strong sense of social solidarity and responsibility. And I feel like I do not want to do reckless things that might cause, you know, myself to be a vector of spread to more vulnerable people, because all of us are vulnerable, of course. So there's that. And also, like, I'm kind of an introvert. So what do introverts do for fun? Like, you know, we have a couple of people over, or we, you know, we think a lot and we write passionate letters or something like that. Like, I think it'll be a low-key kind of celebration, but it'll definitely be a marking of the day. I'm lucky to be married to somebody who's almost exactly a year older than me. So I sort of feel like he's ventured ahead on the path and he's cleared some weeds away. And now, like, the trail has been blazed for me, which he literally does every day of his life for me in the physical world. He has a tractor and he goes out and he blazes trails in the woods behind our house when things overgrow. So I feel like he's doing that physically and metaphorically.
It's good to have a trailblazer in your life. It's a nice thing.
It really is.
So coming back then to midlife, I know that you've written books on midlife. You've written a really great book, Navigating the Messy Middle, a fiercely honest and wildly encouraging guide for midlife women. I mean, thank you. Thank you for the optimism.
I appreciate that.
Can you tell us a little bit about, after years of research in midlife, can you tell us what the term midlife means to you?
Absolutely. I think when I first started researching my book, I knew I would want to take a deep dive into the research. So I read a ton of stuff. Like, I read 1,000 journal articles and 100 books, and I interviewed 118 women. But what I was really looking for were narratives that acknowledge that it's a complicated and nuanced life stage. It's not something simple. You can't boil it all down to a one-size-fits-all formula. And that even includes the age range. Like, I think for the longest time, people wanted to be able to say that midlife magically starts on your 40th birthday and it goes till you're 65, or 35 to 60, you know, like something in that kind of range. When really the midlife researchers that I respect the most talk a lot more about it being a very individual journey, and that maybe it less than sort of fixating on the number of candles on your birthday cake, you want to think about like the broader terrain of your life. So maybe you're going through some major life transitions. If you're a parent, maybe your youngest child just left home, or you've had a career upset or curve or something, right? Like, something in your life has sort of signaled to you, I'm turning a page. This is the end of this chapter, and now I'm stepping into the next chapter. That kind of psychological feeling. But, you know, I love being a midlife person. Like, I have to say that it has been the best life stage for me. That's not to say it wasn't hard and messy. Like, there were some chapters where I literally hit the wall in terms of burnout and exhaustion and a lot of health challenges. But then leaning into that sense of self-knowledge, knowing I've been through hard things before, and that I can draw upon that earlier strength and that earlier learning. Like, honestly, I think if you had to sign up for a life stage to live through like the challenges of the early months of the pandemic, like, it was a good time to be at midlife, because there was that deep soul searching and like reflection layered on top of, you know, what was happening in the wider world. So I think just knowing that, yes, this is going to be really hard and I've been through really hard things before. That I think is how I got through that early time. And I often think about, like, what would my 30-year-old self have been like? I would have been completely flipped out.
Mm-hmm. Was there a particular incident or event or turning point for you when you realized, oh, I feel like this is a new chapter. I am now in midlife.
Yes. I think it happened when I was 49 and I realized that I was about to cross the threshold into my 50s. My mom died at a fairly young age. She died of cancer when she was 63. And I think it was staring down that 50th birthday and thinking to myself, what if I only have 13 years left? Like, you know, it's not like you have some script where you're defined to follow in your parents' footsteps, but it certainly was a wake-up call to me that I don't necessarily have endless time. So I think I really started taking better care of my health. I started being more conscious about the kinds of projects and work things I wanted to be involved with, and just recognizing that none of us has endless time. So I think that's part of the joy of midlife for me, is that sense of like reflection and self-knowledge and being able to connect the dots between past, present, and future in a way that maybe wasn't like such a part of your life when you were younger. I love having that broad and expansive view. Like at this time last year, I went to the top of a mountain summit near my home. And I remember standing there and looking all around me and thinking, like, this is the view from midlife. I can see off in all directions, you know, where I've been, where I am, where I'm going. And I just love that. I mean, it makes life complicated. I think you and I were joking around the other day when we had a little, you know, pre-planning call about how you can never just make a statement like, this is the rule in this situation. You have to have an asterisk or footnotes, or, you know, say and yet and however 10,000 different times. But, you know, I think that's really honest and real, and life is complicated.
It is. And, you know, first of all, I love the summit story. I just turned 50 this summer. And recently, my husband and I went to Aspen. We went when the Aspens were in full autumn glory, right? It was stunning. And we climbed to the top of a summit. And I remember feeling like this is the perfect way to think of being 50 for me, because I am strong enough and capable enough to prepare for a long hike, to do a nice long hike, even though there's altitude, because I'm coming from a low altitude. So the altitude was significant. And then up on the top, really taking a look around and being able to see, just like you said, from the summit, really being able to take in the world around you. And then also knowing to rest afterwards, like coming down and taking the time to rest, making sure that I was taking care of. The whole experience felt like how I feel about the midlife experience right now, which was just lovely. So I'm glad that you had a similar experience. I feel connected to you. It's nice to have those points of connection in our narrative.
It really is.
So you have interviewed, 118 women? That's a lot of narratives.
It really is. But, you know, it was an amazing process, because most of the calls were done, or the interviews were done via Zoom. So it was like the conversation we're having today, right? Just one-on-one, being able to sort of find those points of connection and learn from one another. Like, I love that so much.
I know that one of your missions seems to be to really change the narrative around midlife. So can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. I think a big thing for me is sort of pushing back against the two sort of predominant midlife narratives. Like, there's the one that tells us that midlife is completely magical, and there's one that tells us that midlife is completely miserable. And I believe that the truth is somewhere in the middle, and hence the title of my book, Navigating the Messy Middle, right? So I think that I like stories that are really honest and personal and that are anchored in what we ourselves have lived through. And I think that we can learn so much by swapping those kind of stories with other women. Like even just with, you know, the menopause chapter in my book, there was one woman who said that she just wasn't finding enough information about the menopause journey until she set up a Facebook group with other women. And then no matter what weird symptom somebody would raise, somebody else would say, oh yeah, that happened to me too. And finding that commonality, because it's not a simple checklist. It's not like you might have these three things happen. It's like, here are 75 random things that might happen to you or not. You know, it could be you won't even notice you went through menopause, or you're going to be going, what has just hit me? So I think that's it's the richness of the experience. And in terms of the two predominant midlife narratives, pushing back against the idea that, you know, like the age-defying successful aging thing, which I find super annoying, because who wants to be told they're aging unsuccessfully, right? Like it's just, it's like such a judgy thing. Like as women, have we not had enough judgment and rules in our lives to this point? We totally have. And on the other hand, like buying into those narratives of decline where you could say, well, of course, I'm feeling a little worn down by life, or I have these aches and pains, and this is just the way it's got to be. That can actually take years of living off your life if you don't realize that maybe there is like some temporary, transitory physical issue that you should address with your doctor to get your health back on track, right? So I think that just not settling for any simple formula. When I first pitched this book to my publisher, I was going to call it Midlife Roadmap or something like that, like something that sounded like you'd have like a neat path, and like I'd give you a little map and you'd go, okay, well, I'm 56, so here I am on the map. It's like, no, I quickly blew up that idea and realized that, you know, I could not boil it down to anything simple like that. I'm sure that the book would sell a lot more copies if it was like 7 simple ways to thrive at midlife. I had to give it a complicated title because I guess I'm a complicated person, and I do appreciate really, you know, really deep conversations about things.
And it sounds like you see midlife as an opportunity to engage in those deep conversations, that it's a time that has a lot of potential for deep reflection and deep connection. Is that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, I marked about a 2 or 3 paragraph chunk of my book that I was hoping I could read, because I feel like
wonderful.
It sort of says what I want to say. And hey, I'm a writer, so I tend to sometimes rely on words. So I'm just going to read for a second.
Wonderful.
Okay. Midlife requires a radical imagination, a willingness to tell ourselves new and better stories about our lives. We need stories that reject all the life-limiting narratives that only serve to make life harder and that actively conspire to rob us of joy. We need stories that embrace rather than erase the nuance and contradiction that are woven into the very fabric of this life stage. We need stories that allow us to find meaning in all that messiness. And above all, we need stories that remind us that we don't have to journey through this stage or any life stage on our own. Community means so much to me. Like, I think this probably is going to come up about every 5 minutes in our conversation today, Bree, because literally I'm always looking for ways to build community, to maintain community, just to feel that sense of connection, and not necessarily in a, I have to know all my neighbors. I live in a rural area and it's a little harder getting to know people, but just thinking like, who are the people who have been meaningful to me in my life at various chapters in my life? So a couple of years ago, I reconnected with my first best friend that I had when I was 4 years of age. And we had a beautiful conversation. We don't touch base often, but about once a year we check in with one another. And it's lovely to know somebody who's known you. Like, she knew me before I knew how to read. I can't even remember who I was when I was a person who didn't know how to read or write a book. But she knew me back in that time. And you know what? Her mother is the one who set me on the course to be a reader, because in their family, they were completely book obsessed. And so I never would have dreamed of going out over there to play without having learned about, you know, the Nancy Drew books or reading Little Women together, that kind of thing. So it's fascinating. And at this life stage, like, I want to journey with other women in particular who are really reflecting on, you know, the intersection of age and gender and, you know, all the other sort of intersectionalities of life, right? Like, just having deep and meaningful conversations, because my experience is not universal. I want to talk to other people who've maybe are living with a chronic illness or who have had some struggles with, you know, job loss or any number of other life curveballs. And I can also share some of my challenges. I mean, I am somebody who lives with bipolar disorder and who has a balance and dizziness disorder called Meniere's disease. So I've had to learn some strategies for managing that and not letting those things feel like they completely limit or define my life. So I feel like there's just like this ocean of wisdom, and we can all dive in together. And, you know, you can teach me how to master some skill that I don't even know how to do. Like, I never have gone high altitude mountain climbing. So you could give me like the lowdown down on that. And then if you decide you want to write your first book, maybe you've already done it, but maybe that's in your future, I could tell you, let me tell you how to write a book proposal.
I love that trading and sharing of skills and experiences. Really, it is a beautiful opportunity to connect with each other. You mentioned that you were an introvert. And I think about how we say a lot that we need to develop community, that we need to have community around issues. That's certainly why I do what I do. I know it's why you're doing what you're doing. But so often when our social communities, our social spheres have held a lot of shame or shaming, when we have a culture where we're afraid to say the wrong thing, where we feel like our experience isn't important enough to share, what are some strategies for cultivating, and also just in terms of being an introvert, right? What are some strategies in terms of cultivating community that can help us move beyond those states? Because I think once you get below the surface, many times those things fall away. Once we really create a strong community, we have a sense of safety, we have a sense of belonging, and then we can share with true intimacy. So what are your strategies for doing that?
Well, I think a big thing is realizing that not every single relationship has to be super intense. Like, you know, we often talk to our kids about the fact that, you know, if you have a couple of really close friends in your life, you're really lucky, because, you know, those kind of like soulmate kind of connections, those are a precious and sometimes rare commodity. But we can also know a lot of people. So we moved to this house at about a year ago, like around this time last year. And so I realized that community doesn't just happen, right? So I wrote a letter of introduction to all of the closest neighbors saying, hey, we just moved here and, you know, this is who we are. This is our life story. You're now, you know, living next to a writer, so you're going to get long letters whether you like it or not, and just introduced ourselves. And a couple of the neighbors wrote back, which I thought was great. And I gave them all of our cell phone numbers and said, like, if there's an emergency, just say the word and we'll be over to help. And they did likewise. So I haven't seen them a lot because these are like large rural, like it's a large rural lot. So we don't sort of like bump into each other at the road or something like that. But I know that if there was something weird happening and I was here on my own, I could text message them and say, what does a bear sound like? You know, or some valuable information you really want to have in the moment. And likewise, so I feel like there's that level of connection. And then, like I say, just like thinking back to who are those important people in my life and how do I continue to nurture those relationships? So I have one writer buddy. We write to each other every Friday because, like, being a writer, it sounds a lot more fun and glamorous than it sometimes is. Like, it's a soul-crushing industry. So you need someone else who will be there to cheer you on the days when you're feeling like, why did I even sign up for this? This is like a ridiculous way to make a living. And then, you know, to celebrate the great moments when you're just on top of the world, right? So I have that person. And then I have another friend where we write heart and soul letters, like usually 4 to 6 pages of, you know, single space text on letters that go through the mail. And we do this about once a quarter. So when I get one of her letters, I save it till I have the house to myself. I light a candle. candle, I make a pot of tea, and it's just like being in somebody else's head. And then I take the time to sort of thoughtfully write back to her. So, you know, I think there are all kinds of different ways of being connected. And last week I visited my dad for a couple of days. And while I was in town, I set up a visit to my favorite cousin. I hope my other cousins don't listen to this, but visit to my favorite cousin, a walk with my best friend from high school, a get together with as many sisters as we could get together on the Sunday, and then I drove back home again. So I think just being conscious that if I don't organize that and say to people, like, you really matter in my life, I really want to see you during this little window of time when I'm in town, how can we make that happen? It's not going to happen by accident. So, and especially as up here where I live in the Ottawa Valley, like it is really intense snowy weather from about like beginning of December through to sometime in April. So those are a lot of months where you could feel really cut off and isolated. So trying to think of fun things to do that will recharge my introvert batteries and boost my mood. So next week I'm going to a book event in Ottawa. We're going to turn it into like a one-day mini vacation. And again, I've put out the word to all my friends in the area, like, hey, I'll be in the city. Do you want to come and do something? You know,
how do you continue to reach out and engage in those times when the last thing you want to do is engage? When what you really want to do is go crawl into a hole? What do you do then?
Sometimes I crawl into the hole and I just say to myself, it's part of the cycle of life. And so, you know, maybe I need to be a caterpillar for a week or two. And then other times realizing like I'm feeling high energy, I'm really feeling lonely, I'm missing people. So that's a message to myself that I need to sort of take the time to reach out. And I think that I think we all got zoomed out for a while there, like way too many video calls. So recognizing that maybe it's exhausting for people if I say, let's have a late night video call. Maybe we just both want to be on our cell phones and, you know, having a cup of tea, staring out the window, having that kind of conversation instead, and not being offended if friends are dealing with other stuff in their life and they can't be in constant contact right now. I had a conversation with my best friend from high school, the one I walked with on the weekend many years ago. And she said to me that when I was a young mother and I was really busy with my four kids, she thought I didn't like her anymore because I didn't have time to get together. And then she had kids of her own. And then it all made sense. It's like, now I see you were like running and sprinting through your life. You were exhausted. You'd look up and 6 months would have gone by. It's not that you didn't care. It's just you didn't have any more capacity. And I think at any time, people can be going through that. I recently tried to reconnect with somebody who lives fairly close to our house because we used to live here 30 years ago. And she's still in the area, but she's dealing with layers and layers of family emergencies. And she doesn't even have the capacity to go for a walk in the park, but I can still send her like the odd email just saying, hey, I'm thinking of you, and keeping that connection live so that when she does have more capacity, maybe we can do something fun together.
Beautiful. I think those are some great strategies. So I'm going to tell you what I heard. What I heard here is to use your personal strategy to connect with people. So for you, that's writing, right? You reached out to your neighbors using your personal strategy. My husband is a bit like your husband. He goes out and does work in the yard and helps our neighbors if they need something, if they're cutting down a tree or something, he'll go and haul some wood, which always makes me think of The Tempest. He's my patient log man when he does that. And then for me, you know, I really like deep, intimate conversations. And so honestly, that's the truth. Like I actually don't do well with sort of, hi, what's up kind of conversations, but I know they're a necessary part of life. Maybe. Maybe they're a necessary part of life, but I'll do whatever. I will make a cup of tea or meet up with someone for a cup of tea and we'll go deep real fast, right? That's what we do. So I think that using your strategy, using where you feel that you are in your sort of personal strength or safe place is a great way to go forward with that. Another one is cultivating meaningful connections over time, That's what I really hear in what you've done, that a relationship you may have to let a relationship go for a little bit because of circumstance, but you reach back out and you cultivate meaningful connections. I love your use of ritual. What a beautiful way to bring that into the space of personal intimacy, that you take a letter and you make it a moment for yourself. Really helping you to absorb it and reflect on it is really gorgeous. I love that. And then also, knowing that if you have to take a week or two to be a caterpillar is great. And for me, it's, you know, for me, a week or two may be too long. It may be a day or two. And for other people, maybe they can go for longer. But I think that regularly sort of checking in with yourself and seeing, where is my battery right now? And I'm starting to feel a little antsy or a little lonely. It's probably time for me to reach out in some way. For you, to write a letter. For me, to find someone who will tell me their life story.
Exactly. And it's funny because I often have really open conversations about this. Like when I used to visit my dad, he used to feel really guilty. Like it was his job to take me places and entertain me and talk to me 24/7. And I finally had to say to him, Dad, I'm an introvert. Like just go about your life. Like if you want to go play virtual solitaire or, you know, go online and play bridge with some people, I will not be offended in the least if you're gone for 2 hours doing that. I will sit here reading my book. And when you come back, I'll be happy to continue the conversation. But it's exhausting for me if somebody wants to like talk to me all the time. And I think it was stressing him out too. So now, you know, he says to me all the time, I'm a terrible host. I say, no, you are the perfect host for an introvert.
I love that. I love that. I love that you have that connection with your dad too. Oh, by the way, going back to favorites, I just want to say my grandfather used to tell every single grandchild, niece, nephew, child that each of us was his favorite. So I'm sure that's what's going on for you.
That sure. Could be my any legal cousins? Disclaimer in case a different cousin listens.
That's right. Hey, cousins. Anne loves you all.
Yes.
I would love to talk about how our brains change in midlife. And I think even your talking about reflectiveness makes me think about how I'm a far more reflective person now than I was when I was 20. And I don't know if you feel like the midlife brain has something to do with that, but I know that you are really interested in the midlife brain. So can you tell me why you think the midlife brain is so freaking brilliant?
Well, I think it's something we should be talking about more because like by the time you arrive at midlife, you have accumulated an awful lot of experience and life wisdom, right? Like even in like the animal world, the elephants know that what you want to do is to go and follow the older women elephants if you're going through a time of drought, because they've lived long enough that they know where to find the water holes. And it's the same with us, right? Like by the time you have lived and you have like many decades of living under your belt, you've got an ability to spot patterns. Like, I don't know about you, but sometimes I'm listening to a story in the news and I think, oh no, this is not going to end well. And younger people or my kids will think like, how do you know? It's like, well, I've seen this play out a few times over the years. So I think there's that. And I think just being willing to sort of not come across as a know-it-all, but also being generous with your wisdom and experience and being honest and frank about what you don't know. I no longer feel like I have to prove anything to anybody. So that's why I can suddenly be excited about learning an entirely new skill. I can be excited about trying to teach myself how to write a novel, whereas when I was 25, I would have thought, what if it's terrible? What if nobody wants to publish it? Well, I'm okay with that. Like, it's just, you know, we'll see how the project goes and we'll, you know, I'm writing it more for the joy of writing it than anything else. So I think that there's a lot to talk about in terms of like midlife creativity. Some of the women I interviewed for my book said that society loses a big opportunity when they sort of sideline midlife and older women, because really we have all that knowledge and experience that the world could be tapping into. So why would you want to rob yourself of that incredible resource?
I think about the woman that you interviewed, Martha, right? In the book, there's Martha. And she said, so I'm going to quote the little quote from her in the book, which is, one day they're going to wake up and realize that we're actually ninja feminists, that we've infiltrated everything and nothing is ever going to be the same again. I love that quote.
I love that quote. Yeah. And when she said it, we both had such a good laugh because it's true. Like, you know, if I were to try and organize like a social movement in my community, people would say, oh, it's that sweet woman who goes grocery shopping and stuff. It's like, what if in my grocery bag, I'm carrying all kinds of leaflets and I'm actually helping to plot the revolution? You just don't know. When I was younger, there were a group of activists in my community and they were called the Raging Grannies. I don't know if their chapters are in the US, but they're all across Canada. And what they do is they go to social protests and they sing really tacky songs and they wear really tacky outfits. And they just basically say, you know what? We're here. We've lived a lot. We're loud. We have a lot to say. And here's our political song that is the local politician's nightmare, having us sing about, you know, poverty or peace or something.
Yeah, even the Raging Grannies is such a great name for that. And that makes me think about how we are so, or at least I was so discouraged from expressing rage or anger or anything that would be seen as sort of an aggressive or negative or strident is the word that comes up. I had a Facebook post, not a Facebook post. I had an Instagram post some time ago where I was expressing some anger and somebody wrote to me and said, "Don't be so strident." That's fine. People are going to judge, right? But I think what allows us to even trying to figure out how to phrase this question. I feel like there's got to be something there about our ability to express rage or anger or frustration or discontent without being consumed by it. That feels like it can be a sort of a rite of passage of midlife. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I do. I think that if you are living in alignment with your values, then there are going to be days when you are really angry because this is a really hard time to be a caring, thinking person, right? There's so much injustice. There's so much bad stuff happening in the world. And it wouldn't be honest to sort of say, well, let's just be grateful all the time. Let's just focus on the positive. That's not real, right? And I think that when you're that inauthentic, people pick up on it. Like, you know, sometimes you look at your Instagram feed and you see somebody and they're into like uber gratitude mode. And you just think like, that does not seem real. I'm not resonating with that at all. So I think that we can recognize that, you know, anger, frustration, and rage, they can be fuel to make things better. Like just a wake-up call to yourself that if I am feeling this call to action, how can I use that? And I'm not the kind of person who goes and has like, you know, public temper tantrums. I, like you, I internalized a lot of the good girl messaging of the 1970s or whatever, you know. But I think I can also use a strong voice. I can with my skill being communication and relationship building, I can sort of have conversations in a way that doesn't burn bridges, but that is also really, really fiercely real. Like my dad and I are polar opposites politically, but we're able to have conversations about things in a mutually respectful way. I have long since given up my earlier dream of being able to convert him to my views. And I think he's also had that moment of reckoning, like, nah, I'm not going to sell her on, like, you know, the merits of really hard capitalism. No, she probably has other kinds of views, but we also have a lot of values in common. And I think sometimes you can find that commonality. Like, even with some of the most fringe behavior we're seeing these days, I understand the frustration that has pushed those people to the limits, that has had them buy into conspiracy theories or, you know, the desire to quote unquote burn it all down. Because I have felt that frustration myself. The status quo is nowhere near good enough for any of us. And so some people will react more strongly. And I don't feel like I personally can just say it is what it is, shrug and look the other way. I will always be getting involved in like some kind of new social movement. Right now, I'm really into green burial. I guess it's a late in life kind of cool hobby to have. And so, you know, as long as you have something that allows you to feel like you're pushing the needle of change in the right direction, even if some days it feels like it's reset itself to zero, it's like, okay, fine, let's nudge it to one today.
Yes. Yes. And I think also that comes down to, you talked before about the sort of avoiding the know-it-all mentality. And I think for me, my challenge and opportunity, if I'm looking at it from a more positive viewpoint, is finding ways to explore discontent and anger and frustration that aren't limited by the need to know it all. There's no way to know it all. And so really not engaging in that know-it-all mentality, which I'm guilty of doing. You can ask my children, but you know, we keep growing and learning. I think also that what you've touched on there is finding the ways to hold our needs in, I'm not going to say boundaries, because I think boundaries is kind of overused right now, even though I've used it a lot, but sort of being aware of our tolerance for differences in opinion, for different conversations, like you with your dad. There are sometimes that we have greater capacity for holding space for those conversations, and sometimes when we're just not going to be able to. And knowing when that is and being aware of that can help to keep us from having unproductive conversations. And by productive, I don't necessarily mean that you change somebody else's thought, but that you are operating from that place of, we have common values and we can relate to each other as full human beings because we understand and share this foundation. But sometimes we just can't, right? Sometimes it's just like, how the hell can you think that?
I think that a couple of things from my parenting life, because I mean, I spent most of my career writing parenting books, have been really helpful to me in other domains. One is validating the other person's feelings. You don't necessarily have to agree with their emotions or their, like, their perspective, and increasingly even their description of the facts. Like, so you might not be able to connect on sort of like objective reality, but you can validate the underlying emotion. Like, it sounds to me like you're having a really bad day and that you've just been dealing with layers and layers of challenges. And then that sort of opens the door to continue the conversation. And also, like, the idea of autonomy supportive parenting carried out into other domains. Like, there's no better way to get your 20-something kid mad at you than by telling them what they should do. You should do X. The moment you say that, they want to do the opposite just to prove that they're, you know, a grown-up person in their own right. And that applies to other adults. Like, I have one friend, who every time I express that I'm dealing with a challenge, starts spouting advice at me, and it drives me around the bend. Like, this person will go so far as to look up a YouTube video on something that doesn't even solve my problem and send me the link. It's like, here, I solved your problem in 5 minutes or less. Watch this. It's like, now I feel totally invalidated and like you're treating me like I'm an idiot. Like, surprise, surprise. My job is to research things. So usually if a quick Google search can reveal something, chances are I've tried that Google search.
Truly. And yet I can also imagine that the friend is trying to engage in the way that they know how, right?
What I really need is her just to say, you know, oh man, the day you are having, I really hope it turns around, because boy, I would be so frustrated if I were in your shoes. Like, just like they say, sometimes men have a a tendency to think that what you want is for them to take charge and solve problems. Sometimes that's not what I'm asking for at all. It's just like, let's just talk about how the fact that this problem exists really sucks. And I'm okay with being mad about that for a while.
Yes, to be seen and held in compassion. That's pretty much what I ask for in all relationships.
Yeah.
And, you know, but sometimes we get more than we ask for. So you write for Psychology Today. You have an ongoing blog for Psychology Today.
Yes. Yeah, I write for them about once a month. Yep.
And so that's a great way to hear what you have to say, to hear what you're researching and learning about midlife. What are other ways that we can get in touch with you?
I have a website, annedouglas.ca, so with the Canadian extension at the end. And I link to all my social media things from there. Whenever I write a new article, I tend to add it to my list of news and events and articles and that kind of thing. And I spend way too much time on social media. I will be the first to confess that, because a lot of my learning still happens via social media, especially on Twitter. Like, I know Twitter has like so many bad things about it, particularly in recent years, but I'm connected to a lot of really creative thinkers, social justice people, and I learn something every time I log on to my feed. Now, of course, logging on at 11 o'clock at night before I go to bed is not a good idea, because then my brain's firing with ideas. So it's a constant battle with me. I try to tell myself, you're allowed to check social media late afternoon and then right after dinner, and then you're done for the night, and then just watch something mindless on TV or read a book or whatever. So
what's your favorite TV show right now? What are you watching?
I just finished watching The Morning Show, and I really loved that. And I think I was the last person in the world to watch The Newsroom, which is, you know, like a 10-year-old TV show. But the emotional, passionate speeches, like characters who have like a fierce moral compass, and they care about things, and they will debate freedom of the press and all those kind of things. Like, when I watched the first episode, like, they had me for all three seasons. It's like, I just want to hang out with people who are moved to give spontaneous TED Talks 24/7.
I love it. And what are you reading?
I am always reading about seven different things. So if I look around, I'm reading Inciting Joy. I'm reading a couple of short fiction collections. I just finished reading Doppelganger by Naomi Klein, and it is fantastic. It's one of the best books I've read all year. So usually
that is on my list.
It's so good. So it's usually a mix of nonfiction and fiction. I try to sort of like weave them both together. And it's funny. It's like that snowball effect where you find something and then that leads you to other things. And always, like, I have not a to-be-read pile, but a to-be-read bookcase. And I don't even have enough room for all the books in this room. My bedroom closet is partly a to-be-read bookshelf.
Well, you have found the right career.
I have. And you know, it was so funny, because when I was a young adult, I said to somebody, like, you know, everybody wants to write a book, right? And the person looked at me like, no, not everybody wants to write a book. It's like, that was a life-changing moment. It's like, wait a minute, some people want to be hockey players, or they want to, you know, start their own restaurant. Like, they don't want to write a book? I had no idea.
I'm going to ask you one last question. And that is, if you had one wish for people in midlife, what would it be?
I have to make it a double whammy, because I just can't choose between the two things. So I think, find other women or other people to journey with as you venture through midlife, and self-compassion. Like, learning about self-compassion was life-changing for me. So being able to say to yourself some days, I'm doing the best that I can in a really difficult situation, and letting those words really sink in, and treating yourself with the same kindness that you would extend to a friend who's struggling. I'd spent 49 years being really self-critical, and I'm about 10 years into being self-compassionate. And it's no wonder I loved my 50s so much more than all those earlier decades in my life.
Oh, you're making me so excited about turning 50. I just have to tell you.
It's going to be amazing. Like, you will be jumping up and down with joy at least some of the time. I can promise you that.
And I hope that you have a beautiful 60th birthday. Thank you for sharing your time with us. And I look forward to following your writing because I am really moved by your perspective on midlife. And I think it's a great resource for people like me.
Thank you so much for this conversation. I've been looking forward to it all week and for good reason.
Here's my call to action for this episode. That's what they call it when I'm trying to get you to do something. I want you to do something, and that is to share your story. So if you would like to share an experience of your midlife delights, agony, or just plain humor, you can leave me a voice memo on my new website, pause2gopodcast.com. There's a tab on the right side of the website that says something like, leave me a voice memo. And you can just record a voice memo for me right there and I'll get it. And if you feel comfortable having me share your voice on the pod, then I can share that with everyone. It's so nice to hear other people's voices. But if you don't feel comfortable having me share your voice, I can just anonymously share your story. It'll be great to have your stories on the Pause to Go podcast. All right, stay curious, y'all. Thank you for listening to the Pause to Go podcast. Special thanks to Codebase Coworking and WTJU Radio for their support. This has been an Awkward Sage production.